bicycle deal.
Absolutely not.
Come back from Portland to Brooklyn. I mean, somebody's orchestrating all of
this. Good afternoon. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Friday, April 3rd.
Close.
We will be carrying over House Bill 2815. We will not be hearing or having a work session on that bill today. So today I'm going to start out with 2369, then 2371, and then 2255. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on 2369. And first up, could I have Vern Sabo and maybe John Powell?
Steve's going
to
go up.
Oh, Steve.
There we go.
I was guessing at who was on the sheet. I didn't see Steve sitting back there. Well, welcome back, and good afternoon. And I understand that you've been working hard on this issue for a while, and I know it's been a little bit of a struggle getting us to where we are today, but perhaps you could review the, as soon as Victoria reviews the bill for us, you could tell us a little bit about the amendments. Thank you. Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2369 establishes conditions under which an insurer may settle with individual injured in motor vehicle accident, prohibits settlement which is entered into less than 60 days of accident, restricts insurer ability to recover personal injury protection benefits, and does not include clear statement of consequences of entering into a settlement agreement, exempts traffic crash exchange reports prepared by law enforcement from public records disclosure.
Thank you. And whichever, Vern, would you like to introduce yourself for the record, and or would you rather have Steve Morrow go first?
I think Steve's going to go.
Yeah. Okay.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Morrow with State Farm Insurance Companies. It's been a long journey to get where we are today, but I think that where we are is we would like to have the bill amended with the -4 amendments and moved out, and I would like to speak to what the -4 amendments will do to the bill. Essentially, the -4 amendments replace the current Section 2 with new language that had been in the previous amendments that were proposed. What that will do is it will require an insurer who settles with a person who is eligible to receive personal injury protection benefits to provide in their release that that release is not going to impair that person's ability to go to their insurer, get personal injury protection benefits, and have that personal injury protection benefit insurer then recover that money from the liability insurer. That's for the first 60 days following the accident. After 60 days, that wouldn't be required. The idea is that within the first 60 days, a person may not have as good of grip on where their injuries are as they will after that 60 days. So it provides some consumer protection in the early stages of the claim in that I'm getting money from the other person who's at fault, insurance carrier. That's my settlement. What you don't always necessarily realize is that will foreclose your right to get your own medical benefits from your own insurer. This will prevent that, so the person will be able to go to their own insurer. The second part of Section 2, Subsection 1, and just is just what I just described. Subsection 2 preserves the right of the liability carrier to negotiate and fight out with the PIP insurer the amount of the claim. What typically happens is when a personal injury protection insurer pays the no-fault benefits to their own insured, they go back to the liability carrier, that fault party, and say, I want that money back. They're allowed to do that by statute, but to the extent that the person receiving these benefits was at fault or may have received things that they shouldn't have been paid for, those things are negotiated out and arbitrated between the companies by present statute. Subsection 2 preserves that process that's currently in our law. The part that we were not able to reach agreement on, despite a lot of work, was the public record part with preventing people from getting crash reports and getting that information to solicit patients and customers. The -4 amendment drops that piece of the bill completely out, so it's only Section 2 that survives with the amended language. With that, I don't know if Vern has anything to add or if there are questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vern Sable, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I just want to make a final comment relative to the public records release. We started off with legislation that basically said that you couldn't get to those records, similar to a restriction as the Department of Motor Vehicles. We then amended that to something that would allow, with a clear, shown clear public interest, the ability to get to those records. That didn't satisfy the newspapers, so then we suggested that, well, just if staff would block out the personal contact information of the consumer, their home address, their home telephone number, their driver's license number, that was not acceptable as well. Then we suggested, well, okay, in newspapers, you can get the crash injury reports. I mean, you don't report all of them. You don't report the private information of the consumers, and it's only a few that you report that you feel that are newsworthy. But for everyone else, including these individuals who are getting these crash injury reports to solicit customers, clients, and patients, staff blots out your home address, your home telephone number, your driver's license number. That was not acceptable to the newspapers as well. So lastly, we attempted to do what they suggested, what we've looked at for some time, but were concerned with the First Amendment rights, was to make it an unlawful practice to utilize those crash injury reports for solicitation purposes. LC said, you can't do that, which is what was anticipated. So I just wanted to say to Mr. Chair, the members of the committee, that understanding the nature of the problem, these are basically unscrupulous individuals, vendors, who have their agents go down to the city of Portland, for example, and get a laundry list of these crash injury reports. Now, those injury reports filled out by a police officer have information that you're required by law to give that police officer, which is your home address, your home telephone number, your driver's license number. These are not scrupulous individuals, and ID theft is a concern as well. So I just wanted to make the comment that is it in really in the public interest, under the blanket of public being able to get to government records, is it really in the public interest for anyone, including not the least of which these unscrupulous individuals that utilize these crash injury reports, to call at all hours? Nothing prevents them from showing up on your doorstep. Is the public really served by allowing that to happen? And I just hope that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that you'll consider that during the interim. I will be presenting information relative to more blatant fraudulent activity that seems to be associated with these same individuals, and hope that we could possibly revisit this in the future. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if Andrea Meyer is going to be speaking on this. I have a great concern about... you are or not? No, she doesn't sound like she is. But a great concern about what Dr. Sable was saying, that this is public information, that when I'm rear-ended by someone, that anyone can get the information about my home phone number, my birth date, my driver's license. Well, I don't know what they do with it, but that it's accessible to them is very concerning to me. Is this something we're going to be dealing with in this committee, Mr. Chair?
Well, certainly we had an opportunity to deal with that in this bill previous to this amendment, and we did not have the votes at that time to move this bill out of this committee. So, you know, if we could recess and do a little poll and see if we want to go back to that, certainly. But there were some issues with that as far as, you know, the public disclosure and public records laws.
But if I could do a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So, Mr. Morrow, was this in your best interest to eliminate that part of the bill?
Chair Holby, Representative Tomei, that part of the bill was actually something that Dr. Sable brought to us, and we were okay with it, but it was not something that was that we were even aware of until he brought it. So I can't say it's in my best interest. It just didn't work out.
And I'll follow up. I believe Tom Gallagher spoke against that particular piece, as well as I think Representative Barton as well had some issues with that public disclosure piece. You know, it is a tough issue, and it's also been brought up that perhaps the Chiropractic Association could deal with this through licensing as well. And I think that's something that perhaps you know, through their own board, be able to try to address that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it's not just the chiropractors that I'm worried about. It's it sounds like anybody would have access to this information, right?
Yes.
So I'm not sure that Mr. Sabo can deal with that with the chiropractic board. Anybody can have access. Am I correct in reading it that way?
When it comes out in the newspaper, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, we've been looking at this for 2 years, the Board of Examiners and the Chiropractic Association, and we are strongly interested in doing something of significance. What we were told, which was validated by the Assistant Attorney General to the board, was that to sanction doctors based on this, and again, it was one individual, would violate their First Amendment rights. And Legislative Council basically confirmed that. I will tell you that as a board, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners and the Association, we're looking at doing just that nonetheless, and that those few outliers, at this point one, the wish to challenge the board and the association under ethics violations and roll the dice and spend the money, so be it. But that's why we came to this body, was because of what we were being told legally.
I can understand that. I'm sorry to belabor this, but I guess I'm not particularly concerned about that outlier who is certainly abusing this ability to get public records, but I'm just concerned about that anybody has access, not just that one person, and it sounds like maybe your board can deal with that person, but I'm concerned that anybody can get hold of that information.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, by and large, what's occurring is these are vendors who individuals will pay a monthly fee for this vendor and their agents to go down and get these accident injury reports and then supply and try to funnel customers, clients, patients to those entities. And so it's a myriad of folks that are involved. And as I said earlier, there seems to be a nexus to these individuals which goes on into blatant fraudulent activity. And again, I remind the committee, we would like to move the bill as it is. But the last piece that we suggested was, okay, the media, newspapers can have access to these crash injury reports, which by law you have to fill out or give this information to the police officer. But then for anyone else, including these unscrupulous individuals who use it for solicitation purposes, staff simply blots out your home address, your home phone number, your driver's license number. We didn't think that was too much to ask. Apparently it was. Thank you.
Follow-up? For whom was that too much to ask?
The newspapers.
The newspapers here?
Just a minute. We'll bring up some more people on this issue in a minute. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy with the amendments where they're at right now, and I would be very interested in working with Mr. Sabo if he's willing on doing a bill kind of crafted the way we went after debt collectors and harassing phone calls, and deal with the matter in that instance. I think it's a better way of going about it if Mr. Sabo is willing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would be very interested.
So just for information, we had a previous amendment that left this piece in the before the dash fours that basically disallowed that information from being out there. Probably was that the dash threes, I believe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, dash threes was a piece where the private information was blotted out, as I recall.
Chair, members of the committee, dash three, as I recall, was the first round of testimony. It had been suggested to us that we take it out of the prohibited release of public information section of the public records law, drop it into the permissive section where you could make a showing and be able to get at that information, but it wasn't per se prohibited. And then it gave a class of a few exceptions, like insurers and the parties and attorneys that could get a hold of that information, and insurers only if they used it for the insurance purpose that it was obtained. And that's where we went with that, but that was not a satisfactory solution to the other parties.
To the newspapers, right. Primarily.
Yep. And if I could just mention Chair Hovey, too, and I didn't want to mention it now because I'm afraid of not having a chance to put on the record. When this gets over the Senate, Senator Metzger has been working with us on another consumer protection piece that we would like to see incorporated in this bill, but we'd like the bill passed out as it is today with the idea that we're going to work with him on the Senate side, and that would be basically incorporating into the bill a cooling-off period for a settlement. That if a settlement was obtained in person from a person, there would be a cooling-off period during which that person could rescind that agreement. And we've been in discussions with Senator Metzger, would like to use this bill as a vehicle, and so if you do pass it out, we'd like to at least have the idea out there that you know we're intending to do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose a note. I feel like in some ways our discussion, perhaps consternation today, is an unfortunate consequence of essentially two different issues in one bill. One amends ORS 742, the insurance code. One is public records law, 192, I believe. These are analytically distinct issues. Reasonable people could agree with one, both, or some combination. And I just find this unfortunate. I think these are two very different issues that should survive on their own merits.
Thank you for that, Representative Barton. Sometimes issues involve more than one statute at a time, though, solve a problem.
Respectfully, Mr. Chair, I don't believe this is one of those times.
Well, good people can disagree. So is there any other questions from the... not seeing any right this moment. Thank you very much for your work, and look forward to the conversation on the other side of the building around this bill, too. If I could get Mr. Gallagher and Andrea Meyer to come up briefly.
Chair Halsey, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Representative Tomei, you indicated some concern, and while there's a balancing issue going on here in terms of people's information, which is all over the public record, the property taxes for my home, and there's my name and my address. And so I think there's a bigger issue going on, which is the public records law has been replete with exception after exception after exception, and it's done in little increments, and it's becoming increasingly a concern of ACLU and I think our other folks. And while each piece may look attractive on its own or a little bit, I think it really behooves a larger conversation. I was pleased to know that although I had not been participating at a certain point, that OMPA and others opposed the concept of distinguishing the public record access from newspapers or media versus other people. That is not the public records law. I hope it will never become the public records law. We do not distinguish between the media and everyone else. There's a great quote that I don't have in front of me in the Attorney General's manual about busybodies and snoops and government agencies, and everyone has the right to it the same. And we do not distinguish between who you are and why you are asking for something that is a public record. And that is something that I hope we never change in Oregon, because that's not what government should be asking, is why you want it. Whether we need to be looking at a larger place, we've become more sensitive to issues in public records and social security numbers and other issues, but at the same time we need to be careful that we don't start redacting everyone out of everything, because there might be a situation that it looks or could appear a problem. We're in a lot of public records with our name and our address and our phone numbers, and so.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, representing the OMPA, I'd be repeat things that were said. I'd be happy to answer questions, and just in general, I agree with Vice Chair Widener that this really is a consumer fraud issue, and we should be dealing with it as a consumer fraud issue. These records have been available to the general public since 1973. You've never had a complaint about people using the identity theft or anything else off these public records. In this case, I think there is an abuse going on, but I don't think it's an abuse of the public records. I think it's an activity that should be prohibited.
Thank you. Representative Krieger?
Just briefly, anyone who ever served in this building provides all that information right in the voter pamphlet. And the only thing that's out there maybe is your social security number, but if you got the other, you could probably get that too with the new technology of today. So, you know, how it's used is the problem, when it's being misused, not that people have it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I didn't bring my statute with me on this one. There are places where home records and social security numbers are excluded or they're redacted from public records for identity theft type issues. So there are protections that are built into the general public record disclosure law.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Not seeing any right now. So is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2369 and open the work session on House Bill 2369.
Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Go ahead.
Stereo.
I'll stay out of this. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4 and 2 amendments into House Bill 2369.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves the dash 4 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2369. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the dash 4 amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 2369 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2369 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to ask if there is a committee member, particularly Representative Barton, who would just briefly tell me their passion for the fours in this bill.
Passion for the what?
I'm sort of a personal question. That's up to Representative Barton.
Passion for
that's how I feel about minutes. This committee.
Passion for what?
Dash fours. Right? Did we just say yes?
Yeah.
What's your passion for the dash fours?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. In fact, perhaps I should cover. The dash fours incorporate essentially, as I truly believe, these are two. Different bills that have been crammed into one bill, and I think they're analytically entirely distinct. I'm a strong supporter of the first part of this bill. There's been consensus reached. I am an opponent of the second part of the bill. I believe that public records law in Oregon is really dying a death by a thousand cuts. I've had the privilege of serving in this chamber for about, I think, well, this is week 13. I've been asked...
We're well aware of that.
Yeah, I've been asked to, to create an exception to public records law, I think 8 times now. Each time, I might add, actually makes some sense. However, if you look at it, the exceptions have entirely swallowed the rule, which is that public documents are presumed just that, public. And I'm going to start drawing a line in the sand. We need to, in fact, frankly, I think we're going to have to rethink public records law in this state.
Thank you for the explanation of your passion. Any other discussion? Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2369, having received the required votes, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And would someone like to volunteer to carry this?
I think the passionate member of the committee should.
Chair, I'd nominate Representative Gilliam, actually.
But any volunteers? Representative Widener, thank you for volunteering. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2369. Next up, I think I'm going to go out of the order I previously signed up. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2255. Sorry about jumping around a little bit. Victoria,
yes,
can you give us a brief review of where we are with House Bill 2255 and a description of it, please?
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2255 prohibits manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperative from issuing stock, creates limits and restrictions on membership in manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperative. We have dash two amendments in front of us, and we have all the necessary documentation to deal with them.
Thank you. Yeah. John Van Landingham, please.
Yes.
Really?
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming on a Friday afternoon to perhaps move this bill on to the next level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. With me is Peggy McGuire from the Department of Housing and Community Services. I'm not going to say much about this bill. I've given you a written explanation of the why we're here and section by section. I testified on February 2nd. The dash twos totally replace the bill. So if you do choose to move it, what you want to move is the dash two amendments. Delay in coming back from February 2nd was working with legislative council to get the bill to do what we wanted to do. What this does is help us make effective an effort you started in 07 with manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperatives. It makes some changes in how those cooperatives work so that we can encourage, not require, but encourage banks to lend on homes in the park. The banks have indicated support for the changes. They do things like require a co-op to notify a bank if a co-op membership is being terminated so that the bank can protect its asset. Gives the bank the right to maintain the manufactured home in the space in the park for up to a year while it looks for a buyer. So in other words, it's trying to help the bank protect its asset and encourage the bank to lend on the home. In New Hampshire, the model we're trying to follow, banks lend on those homes as if they were real estate. Otherwise, a manufactured home in a park is treated as if it were an automobile. In terms of lending, it's personal property. You get a 3-year or less loan, and you pay much higher rates. Manufactured homes in co-op parks in New Hampshire are treated as real estate. They get much more favorable loan rates and longer-term mortgages, and we're trying to encourage Oregon banks to do the same. And this is part of that effort. I can talk longer, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Does anyone have any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the example from New Hampshire. Do you have any information on Delaware in this case?
Chair Hovey, Representative Gilliam, I don't. I know that a number of states are trying to learn the New Hampshire model. And New Hampshire is actually, that nonprofit has created a national nonprofit and partnered up with the Ford Foundation to promote their model in other states. I think Oregon fairly could be described as being the farthest along to be like New Hampshire, although New Hampshire's been doing this for 25 years and we've got a ways to go. I think that Delaware is one of the states that's interested in copying the New Hampshire model.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. McGuire, did you want to testify?
Chair Hovey and members of the committee, thank you. I'm Peggy McGuire from the Community Resources Division at Oregon Housing and Community Services. Our division administers the Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations Program, and I was merely here to support Mr. Van Landingham and also to say that we support the amendments that have been made.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I should probably note that there's one other big thing that the bill does, and it addresses concerns raised by the Department of Consumer and Business Services last session, that a membership in this co-op could be treated as a security and ought to be regulated as if it were security. We would not like that to happen because it would require a bunch of expensive lawyers. So we've worked with DCBS in the interim. DCBS in January completed the process of adopting a rule exempting memberships in these co-ops, and we've made changes to the co-op statutes to, for example, to remove references to things like shares of stock or dividends, so that consistent with our agreement with DCBS.
Thank you. Appreciate the work that you've put in and making this a what I think is a good piece of legislation.
Great, thanks.
Any other comments, questions? Representative Callan.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. Is it which set of amendments are accomplish what you just detailed for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, the dash two amendments.
The dash ones are off the table.
Then. Correct. The dash twos replace everything.
Where did you get the dash
one? The dash twos replace the dash one and the introduced bill. It's a gut stuff.
Still on the same subject. Follow up. We'll need to kind of catch up then in a summary because there's still a lot of references to stock, and I'm just trying to.
Representative Cowan, in the dash two, the only reference to stock that's left is a prohibition on issuing stock, consistent with the agreement. So this has been shared with DCBS.
Okay. All right.
I think everybody, all the parties are up to speed on it, although I understand it's a lot for you to get at the last minute.
Yes, thank you. So the staff measure summary, Representative Cowan, I think is still accurate that we have in front of us.
I understand that. It would be helpful if somewhere along the way we can kind of get a summary of what we just heard so that we know what the bill actually accomplishes.
Right. I'm sorry. So Chair Hovey and Representative Cowan, I don't... Victoria, did you give them my testimony?
No, I thought you were bringing it.
I did bring it,
and I just
didn't think to hand it out.
Let's do that.
Which was pretty stupid. Oh. So can you give that?
That might be helpful.
That would be helpful. So that, or I'm referring to something that you don't have. I'm sorry. It's my fault.
Thank you.
We'll wait a few minutes and let that get distributed.
So the second and third pages of my written testimony have a section-by-section explanation of what's in the dash two.
That's what I need, my cheat sheet.
Sorry.
Would the committee like to recess for a few minutes to take a look at this?
No, I'm fine.
Mr. Chair.
It's in Wingard.
John. Just wanted to thank you for spending the time to stop in my office and walk me through a little bit about what had been going on in New Hampshire. And I think I probably don't, it's probably not possible to get to your level of enthusiasm about it because you live it every day, but I am excited about the prospects for following that model here. And again, just thank you, and I'm happy to support the bill.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any other questions at the moment. And again, I appreciate your work on this.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2255? Not seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2255 and open a work session on House Bill 2255.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wingard.
I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2255.
Representative Wingard moves the dash two amendments be adopted to House Bill 2255. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting those amendments? Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted to House Bill 2255.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wingard.
I would move the committee pass House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended. Thank you.
Representative Wingard moves House Bill 2255 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just again, Mr. Chair, I really do think there's good potential here to solve an issue related to mobile home parks, and I think the model that John has invited us to follow from New Hampshire is a good one, and this bill doesn't get us totally there, but it gets us on the path, and I'm just very pleased to support it.
Thank you. I share your sentiment on this. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton. Aye. Representative Callen. Aye. Representative Gilliam. Aye. Representative Krieger. Aye. Representative Matthews. Excused. Representative Tomei. Aye. Excused. Representative Winger. Aye. Vice Chair Widener. Aye. Vice Chair Riley. Aye. Chair Holby. Chair votes aye.
House Bill 2255, having received the required votes, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Cowan, with the cheat sheet in front of you, you think you'd be comfortable carrying this bill on the floor?
Are you kidding? I'm the one that doesn't understand it.
You'll carry it. You got to volunteer.
I think Representative Wingard likes it a lot better than
I just thought it might be a great educational opportunity.
No, I appreciated that. That was just for the look in her face.
I'm going to start writing questions if she does.
Representative Winger, would you like to carry this bill instead?
I'd be happy to do it.
Thank you. Representative Winger, carry this bill on the floor. Did I close the work session? I forgot.
Yeah, no.
That was a genuine horrified look.
With that, I'll close the work session. House Bill 2255.
That was funny.
It's time. It's Friday afternoon.
With that,
yes, it is.
She's drinking.
Yes,
now.
It is.
I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2371.
Sure you would.
Okay. That was funny.
Victoria, would you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2371?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2371 restricts situations in which private entities may read, store, share, or sell information electronically retrieved from driver's licenses, permits, and identification cards, and I believe we are considering the Dash 5 amendments.
Thank you. And up first, could I have Andrea Meyer, please?
All my friends could come up too at this point, but
you have friends?
I do have friends. Look at these friends.
They look very enthusiastic.
It's Friday.
I think
good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We have brought forward House Bill 2371. There was testimony a few weeks ago from many of the stakeholders here raising a few concerns that we have been working tirelessly to address. I'd like to go through the Dash 5s. You previously had the Dash 1s, which replaced the whole bill. So I'd like to walk you through the changes that we have done, address the one issue that we hope to resolve, ideally over on the Senate side, and try to proceed with the bill. The first page is really the same. It is the definition section. Although we can start at the bottom of the first page, lines 20 begins the instruction of what a private entity cannot do and can do. So at the outset, a private entity may not swipe an individual's driver's license or identification card. And to remind you, the identification card is the government-issued ID card that you get in lieu of an ODL. Except for the following purposes, and let us go through those. The first would be to verify the authenticity of a driver's license or identification card, or to verify the identity of the individual if the individual pays for a good or services with a method other than cash, returns an item, or requests a refund. The second basis for which a private entity can swipe the card is to if the person is receiving age-restricted goods or services, and there's a reasonable doubt that the person having reached 21 years of age. It was decided that's really the area in the law where there's a basis for which the bar or the grocery store or the others would swipe the card. We previously had age restriction, but I'd removed the age restriction in general because I don't think there's a lot of 55-year-olds or 60-year-olds trying to scam with their driver's license to get the senior discount. So we just decided to limit it to the 21. Now, I think the grocers had a clarification and I know Representative Holden and I briefly talked about it, it is intentioned by that section to also include tobacco, which is 18 and under. And to the degree that we need to clarify, just to make sure 21 would be alcohol bars, 18 would be tobacco sales, I'd like to fix that on the Senate side. The language may, in discussion with LC, cover that, but if it doesn't or if there's a tweak we need to make to clarify, we'd like to do that. But the intent is any kind of age-restricted service or goods under the age of 21. All right. Then the third basis for which it can be swiped would be to prevent fraud. And let me just back up. Those first two reasons, I don't think there's any stakeholders in the room other than what I've just discussed. We're fine with those. The third is to prevent fraud or other criminal activity if an individual returns an item or requests a refund and the private entity uses a fraud prevention service company or system. This is to address the previous testimony. Sometimes a private entity may have their own fraud system, or they may contract with another entity. So this language is broad enough to include either situation. Fourth, sub D is to transmit information to a check service company for the purposes of approving negotiable instruments, electronic funds, transfers, or similar methods of payment. And I think Mr. Markey and I will talk about that a little bit more, but that's addressing the concerns that they had. All right. Subsection 3 there goes back to your first two exceptions, the authenticizing a document and the age restriction. And that says you cannot keep this information, period. You can swipe it. You can assure that they are the right age or that they are the right person. You cannot retain it. And that has been fine with everyone that we have worked with. Subsection 4 gets to the issues raised by the folks who've been at the table, and that is then saying a private entity that does swipe it for either to prevent fraud or to transmit information by check may store or share the name, address, date of birth, or driver's license number or identification number collected from swiping the driver's license or ID card for the purposes of preventing fraud or other criminal activity against that private entity. We've limited it to those four data points. That was testimony you heard before the committee, and some of you asked, why can't we just limit it to four? Everyone's agreed that's appropriate, and we're going to do that. Subsection 5 then says a person who receives. That's where if you've contracted with a fraud prevention system, or you are the company that is doing the check service or other fraud prevention, receives a personal information from a private entity, like the grocery store, of this section, they may use the personal information received only to prevent fraud or other criminal activity against the private entity that provided the personal information. You heard Ms. Dave Justice talk about, and he was representing, I think, AOI. Do you remember Mr. Justice came up from California? Excuse me. He talked about the system he provides for different clients, and he silos that information. He doesn't start spreading it around once he gets it and distributing it. And that's an important piece. What we intend to add is what I guess I would call 5B, and that addresses Mr. Marquis's clients that he can talk about a little bit more, but really those probably operating under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. They do share and merge if Fred, you know, just to pick names randomly with no other basis. If Fred Meyer checks someone's check through a client of theirs, they determine they're good. Target might do the same, and they need to share that this is a bad actor or a good actor. So that information is merged, and they're regulated under federal law, and we would be happy to then work an amendment that doesn't give them such the tight siloing that they can share within their own entity that information so that they can do their service. That is really it. The rest, lines 27 on, page 2 onward, are the government entity that has not changed, and there's been no concerns raised about that. So we, I think I would ask the following, and we'll, hopefully others will chime in. I would urge the committee today, please adopt and pass the Dash 5s. You do not yet have the fiscal on this, but it would be ACLU's hope that we would adopt the Dash 5s to get the fiscal on this and then move the bill out. To the two remaining issues that I have been approached in the last 6 or 8 weeks of negotiations, they are the age, making sure under 21 is 18 is fixed, and the issues I've described with Mr. Marquis, fixing for the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and we would like to do those over on the Senate side, because if we continue to delay to tweak the language, we continue to delay on the fiscal. And we know time is getting of essence, and I think, although Mr. Marquis can speak for himself, I think we've been working very tightly together and in good faith to resolve this, and I think we can and will and just don't want to delay. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions and thank this committee for the time. This is important legislation, and we hope you will move forward with it.
I think I'd like to listen to the rest of the panel first, and then we'll open it up for questions. Welcome to the committee this afternoon. I don't know why. I think it's the first time you've been in front of this committee this year.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Must be slipping.
Members of the committee, I'm sure that you're not slipping. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. And I believe when Mr. Justice was before you, I had John Ledger sit in for me. I'm sure he did an excellent job, although I wasn't here to see it. As Andrea mentioned, we do have retail members who use fraud prevention systems that depend on swiping driver's licenses and retaining certain data from those driver's licenses for a very long period of time. In fact, the longer they can retain information, the better their databases will be and the stronger in terms of fraud prevention they will be. So we very much appreciate ACLU working with us on the length of time that we can maintain the data in order to make our fraud prevention system stronger. And at this point, we're happy with the amendments and ready to move forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing the Consumer Data Industry Association today. And just to echo the comments you've already heard, Ms. Meyer, ACLU has been great to work with on this. We do have one issue still with sub 5 that you find on the dash 5 amendments on page 2. But as pointed out to you already, I think we've worked out an agreement that works for us just by simply breaking that section into two parts, one for the retailer and one for the folks that are regulated by the Fair Debt or by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, excuse me. And again, we feel comfortable that we can continue working on this and get that straightened up.
Thank you.
Chair Halvey, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. Actually, Ms. Earls and I have both been working with Mr. David Justice from the firm called the Retail Equation. Just through this hearing was February 18th, and it was late in the afternoon. So if you don't remember everything, neither do I. But Mr. Justice's firm, his sole business is to help retail companies prevent fraudulent returns and exchanges, which evidently is a billion-dollar criminal industry in this country. That's all he does. He works directly with retailers to keep data and to help them prevent fraud. I think because we've been working on the niggling and the exceptions, just to remind you that this bill overall prevents any party from using the data obtained by swiping a driver's license for marketing, to sell it, to, you know, republish it or whatever, with some very limited exceptions. So I just wanted to remind us that we haven't been building exceptions. We built from a common thou shalt not except in these, and we've just really been working for 3 or 4 weeks to get the exact language right on those very narrow exceptions, and I think we've gotten there, and I've been appreciated working with the ACLU on this, and support the bill.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Carlin.
Representative Krieger.
I think I find myself in a position to have to vote with the ACLU.
Again.
I think twice or three times in judiciary, and now again it's getting to be very disheartening.
Chair Halvey, Representative Krieger, your secret is safe with me. Not to worry. I did want to add, because they was mentioned, I failed to do that. One of the reasons we've got these safeguards on its reuse and the fraud prevention is because we did take out the time limitations for how long they could keep it. We started with 30 days. They talked about 3 years. That was our compromise, but trying to silo it in most cases so it doesn't get out there further. Now, I believe the only other thing I want to add is that I think you will hear testimony from Mr. Powell from AT&T, representing AT&T, who approached me only a few minutes before the committee, and I was a little unable to focus in on what his concerns are. I don't know what they are today, and I would appreciate if there's concerns that I can address after he testifies, that I do so. We have been working with everyone who's been involved, and they all came to the table, and it's been a few coffees and a few other things over it, but it's been a good experience, and I really do hope we can move forward and there's not new issues raised now months after this has been worked on.
Thank you. I guess I have one question, or maybe two. On the, I guess on page 2 under that sub 4, I'm kind of curious. I understand the intent of this and agree with it, that for the purpose of preventing fraud, they can store and share, you know, these pieces of information on an individual. But I'm wondering, how do you go about limiting the use of that to make sure that, or how do you make sure that it's just used for the purpose of preventing fraud? I mean, what kind of check or I'm just kind of curious, right, who watches that or how do you make sure that happens?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to sort of guess here. Our experts were here February and they've gone home. I think you heard testimony, if I can recall, that it is in their interest because they are working as a vendor to a private entity to help them with fraud prevention and fraudulent exchanges to hold that information. I think you heard Mr. Justice from the retail equation say that they hold it only to them. They don't let it out of so-called silo to other people. How can we guarantee that anybody always does the right thing? I guess I would say, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. We do a lot of laws. Last session we passed the major identity theft law. We said thou shalt not do a lot of things. At the end of the day, things do have, I think there are some enforcement. There are enforcement provisions at the end of this if someone were to be found out, but there is not a constant monitoring process involved in these transactions, to be honest.
And I would say, yes, that is a concern, both that concern and also because we've agreed to limit what data they can swipe and retain. I mean, they could swipe the card, but they can only retain 4 points, and I don't know how, because as I've testified, when they swipe your card, they get all many other points. So I don't know how, and hope there is a system that, since we've agreed to limit it to name, date of birth, and those 4 points, that they are only swiping, they're only collecting those 4 points off of the license. I don't know how that technology works.
Mr. Chair, Jim Craven again. In talking with the client I've been working with, they're not really concerned if somebody's bringing in fraudulent returns. Their height, their weight, the color of their eyes, those aren't really very valuable pieces of data for what they need it for. There's and again, maybe just to remind the committee that there's no secret data that is obtained by running this card through this device that is not readily apparent on the front of your driver's license. That a person could write that information down or type it into a database. So we're putting some sideboards on electronic new technology. So I think the reason this committee expressed an interest in limiting the fields, and our people said that's fine, that's all we use anyway.
Thank you. It seemed like with technology they could probably have a program that automatically redacts that as they do it. But I wouldn't know. I'm not that technologically advanced. Piece of cake, my vice chair.
You could ask Representative Riley how it works.
Thing, and I have one question for Mr. Marquis on that one section five where you're looking for that being divided in two pieces to address the financial credit check world.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis again. Yes, that's exactly right. And Andrea Myers agreed that the storing of that information at that level could be handled differently and still be safe to consumers because they are highly regulated under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And so we'd separate that the retailer is doing one thing, but once it gets to our level, that you're, if Target, as she said, Target or Fred Myers is sending us information, it can go into the same database so that we can share that information to help prevent fraud across the different retailers.
And Chair Holly, it will be limited to fraud prevention, and we're only able to take it for fraud. So as much as we can, we've put safeguards around it. So Section 5, the reason it didn't necessarily work as drafted for them was because we've actually said, it's similar to what Mr. Justice testified to, he receives it for Client A. He can only use it for Client A. He doesn't merge it with Client B. When we removed any time restriction on how long they can keep it, it was important for ACLU to say, okay, then you need to silo it, and so it doesn't then a year later, 2 years later, get spread further and further. It raised some concerns for the folks who do a broader fraud protection business process and fair credit. You've got the material. And so I am willing to work in with that so that we can move this forward, have those safeguards on there, and particularly stop any new business model or creation where people's data is being swiped. It's being swiped for marketing purposes. It's done without people knowing it. And so trying to keep the eye on the big prize here, this is important to kind of a little bit regulate what's currently going on and also to restrict greatly further advancements in this area.
Thank you. Mr. Riley, question? Thank you very much for your testimony and your
Thank
work
you.
On that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us the time to get it right.
Well, okay. Next up, we have John Powell.
Thank
Good
you,
afternoon.
Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Friday afternoon. Mr. Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing AT&T. Mr. Chair, I missed this bill in February when I was marking bills. So my appearance before you today is based on that. I received a call this morning from AT&T, and they read the original bill, and we had not seen these amendments. My understanding of these amendments satisfy a lot of the concerns they were concerned about. So I'm not here to advocate you do not adopt the Dash 5s today, but we will review it and work with the ACLU should there be any further concerns. AT&T does not share data with third party for commercial purposes. It's used internally. As you know, many of the contracts that a cellular company sells are two-year contracts. So you enter into an agreement that's going to be to last for 24 months, unlike another retail purchase where you just purchase a commodity and you're gone. And in that regard, the payments then are structured out over that period of time. So the data that they get from you is kept during that contract period. The original bill had a provision in it that wouldn't have allowed that, even if it was taken manually. My understanding with these amendments is this only deals with data that is captured by swiping your driver's license or a government-issued card, so we could still input data manually. In the future, it may be that technology gets to the point where systems can be developed not to take all the data. If you are putting serial numbers and things in, there are frequently mistakes made by people keying them in. So someday in the future, it may be necessary to make amendments to allow different things. I know in automobile insurance, auto insurers are required to put the serial number of your car to the DMV. And one of the big problems with that transaction is many times people will miss a number or add a number or invert numbers, and that creates all kinds of problems in that system. So accuracy in the future might have us revisit this. But I wanted to go on record today, somewhat embarrassingly, but put their concerns at least on the record so that we could continue to work on this if there's something in these amendments.
Yeah, and I thank you for that. And I hope you do continue to follow this this bill over the Senate and work with the ACLU and the others that have been trying to work out the issues on this if some develop for you.
Right.
Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, you've served in this body. and I read in the paper that a mere 2,600 bills have been introduced. I cannot believe you'd let this happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gilliam, unfortunately, my clients are following 2,599 of them.
Okay, duly noted. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I didn't have anyone else signed up on 2371. Anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2371, excuse me, and open a work session on House Bill 2371.
I would entertain a motion on the dash 5 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2371.
Representative Riley moves the dash 5 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2371. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the adoption? Seeing no objection, the dash 5 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2371.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 2371 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a subsequent?
No, there is not.
We have a fiscal, Mr. Chair?
We do.
Yes, we have a fiscal report. There is no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Mr. Chair? Perhaps a question of the administrator. I thought the reason why we had to move the dash 5s now was to facilitate getting a fiscal so we can move it to the Senate to work out the additional compromises.
We received the fiscal about
an
see.
Hour
and
yeah,
hours
thank
ago.
You. Perfect.
during this meeting.
It appeared gotcha. Right at the beginning of the meeting, so there's no reason to wait.
Mr. Chair, nothing would please me more than to let our friends in the Senate work on this bill.
Thank you. Me too. So with... With that, is there any other discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Cindy, would you make a roll call vote?
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holmey?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2371, having received the required votes, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer to carry the bill.
Oh, I'd take that one.
Representative Cowan.
I feel like I have to pay my dues now.
Representative Cowan will carry the bill on the floor. Thank you, Representative Cowan. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2371 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2189. Victoria, would you like to give us a brief description of House Bill 2189?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2189 authorizes Oregon's participation in the Nationwide Mortgage Licensing System and Registry, NMLSR, and under the Department of Consumer and Business Services, requires DCBS to adopt rules necessary to conform to the requirements of the Federal Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, requires loan originators to be licensed through NMLSR, requires mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, and other persons who use loan originators to maintain bond or letter of credit, and to retain records of loan originators through NMLSR, sets educational and testing requirements for loan originators, and requires submission of information for criminal records check, specifies grounds for denial, suspension, or revocation of licenses of mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, or loan originators, and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Up first, David Tapman, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me in on this sunny spring day. My name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and that's part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You're having testimony handed out to you. I will try and remain brief. I must say that this is House Bill 2189. We've got dash ones that I understand were provided to the committee today. Mm-hmm. And I've had a brief chance to look them over. It's not quite the same gestation period as it is for a human baby, but it's been 6 months that we've been working on trying to get to the state. So you can imagine our excitement being here. Thank you so much. The history of this matter really comes relatively quickly, and it's the outgrowth of what was the crisis in the housing market that struck so hard in late 2007 and really in full force in 2008. In July of 2008, Congress passed the Home Economic Recovery Act, and as a part of that, they passed something called the SAFE Act, and I believe Ms. Cox has referenced that. The SAFE Act essentially provides a new regulatory oversight of loan originators throughout the United States. This was Congress's attempt to say, look, we have concerns, we have problems that we want to address, and what we want to do is recognize that the states have a pretty robust process for regulating mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, and to some extent loan originators, but we want to ratchet up the oversight of loan originators. Thereby, the SAFE Act was passed into law, and the department is a member of a trade association called the Commission of State Bank Supervisors. I think I mutilated that, CSBS. And what they did was they worked in conjunction with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, to come up with a model act. And that model act has been sent out throughout the states. The state of Oregon, like everyone else, is trying to adopt something approximating that model act. What has been clearly stated is the intent of Congress is if by the summer of 2009 we have not made great strides, in other words, passed legislation to take effect relatively soon, HUD would then take on the full oversight regulation of mortgage lending in a particular state. So we feel like there's some urgency here. We also think that this is a good concept in general. We've worked closely with a number of our stakeholders, and I know that there's representatives here from a number of groups. The Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, I understand, fully supports this. In fact, they have been asking for licensing of loan originators for years. So we think that this goes a long ways towards addressing many of the concerns that you may have heard either anecdotally or through the news, and provides the means for overseeing people who handle probably the most important transaction of any one individual's life. One of our goals is to make sure that we are in compliance. Let me step back and explain what the Model Act does and what we hope to be able to do. There's going to be a national database, the nationwide database that all states are going to use. And every loan originator shall apply to be licensed through that database. So that through that database, there will be, we hope, a form of uniformity. There will be criteria for having background checks in terms of their administrative, civil, and criminal histories. There will be fingerprints reviewed. There will be education requirements. There will be testing requirements. And as you are probably aware, Oregon does a number of those things already, but this will now be in conjunction with a license. And the advantage of this system is if you get licensed and comply and meet those obligations in a particular state, in theory, you should be able to get licensed in every state. So there's a vast amount of uniformity that should apply here. We think that in and of itself has a lot of value and merit. Now, times have changed somewhat since the heyday of our economic boom around housing, but we still have well over 1,800 companies and well over 6,500 licensees, loan originators here in Oregon alone. So we think this will have a significant impact for many of those folks. A couple of things to point out. What will be different is loan originators are the model of this Model Act. And the focus is on the loan originators, the individual who work face-to-face with consumers. Congress has decided, and we support this decision as if we had a choice, but we do support it, in that everyone that's a loan originator should be treated equally. So a consumer finance lender who makes a mortgage-type loan, a loan that is secured by an interest in real estate, that person will be licensed as a loan originator. Certain insurance people who, as producers, are engaged in this conduct, historically were carved out, but they will now have to get licensed if they meet the definition. And manufactured dealer, structured dealer sales force, if they meet the definition, will also have to get licensed. And so what we think is this will allow for uniformity across the board in terms of those who engage in certain types of lending practices, regardless of whether you walk into a company that's known as a mortgage lender or you walk into a company that's known as a consumer finance lender. And they will be treated the same way in terms of getting the licenses and the examinations and all the background. The one exception, and again, this is a congressional exception, is that if a loan originator, which would be known as a loan officer, working for a bank or for a credit union, will not fall under the licensing provisions. Congress has said that they will go through a separate registration process with different criteria. I take that to mean differences around examinations and continuing education, but that registration process will go through the federal regulator. So most of our state banks, that means it goes through the FDIC, since that's the federal regulator. For our state chartered credit unions, it will go through the National Credit Union Association, NCUA. And so that will not be a part of the province of this bill. I realize it's caused some concerns in the past, but that's clearly a bright line that Congress has already given to us, and so we're working within that model. Just to make clear, the definition of a mortgage loan originator, which is the crux of this concept, is to include anyone who takes a residential mortgage loan application or offers or negotiates a residential mortgage loan. And as I said, that covers a wide range and not just our traditional mortgage lenders. The bill has a number of components. I can walk you through them. At this point, I've touched on the high points. It's a fairly traditional method of regulation. We have provisions for application. We have provisions for background checks that I've mentioned and testing requirements. We have provisions for using this national database system. The one thing that we are making some additional changes in is that we are requiring surety bonds to change. Historically, the surety bonds were relatively low in this area, as low as $25,000. What the provisions would call for is up to a $50,000 surety bond. The proposal in the current bill is to do by rulemaking a process of establishing a scaled system by which, depending on the amount of lending a particular loan originator does, the surety bond would reflect that type of volume up to a cap of $50,000. We also have agreed to provide for that individuals don't have to get the surety bond. The company itself can get the surety bond, and in fact, that's the way it currently works, but the surety bond would have to include the acts of the individual loan originators, taking the burden off the loan originator and keeping it with the company. As I mentioned, we've worked with stakeholders on this to some degree. Unfortunately, nobody's really had a chance to vet this closely. It's my understanding that the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals support this. The Oregon Mortgage Brokers Association is in general support of this. I've talked with the Financial Services Association, represented by Paul Cosgrove. He has raised several concerns, not a number. That's an overstatement. There are four concerns, including areas around questions about servicers, loan servicers, people that service loans after they've been sold to creditors, and also around provisional licenses for people who would be now, for the first time in the consumer finance world, having to obtain a license. I think there are ways that we can have an honest and open discussion about that, and I think we can come to a resolution about that. So I realize it's a little frustrating in that we can't say today we are ready to go, but I would like to think in the near future we can get those last couple of issues resolved, come back to you early next week, and either say we've identified and resolved problems or we've identified and can't resolve problems and turn it over to the committee. As there's been some confusion about whether there's a fiscal, there's no question there's a fiscal involved here. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I believe the committee administrator has the dollar amounts involved, and in fact, I've spoken to the Ways and Means in my official capacity on this bill. So with that, I stand ready to do the committee's bidding or answer any questions or step back and come back later if that be the case.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman. I appreciate your comments. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tapman, thank you for coming, and again to our committee. And on page 3 of your testimony, you talk about the exclusions from the federal standpoint. Is it an easy thing to give us a list of those that are excluded under the SAFE Act?
Hey, give me a moment, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, and let's see if I can find it. You're looking at the large paragraph in the middle?
Of your testimony?
Yes.
The last paragraph.
Okay.
Sorry, I meant to follow. He was asking me a question, so I guess it's okay.
Only on Friday.
While he's looking, I do have a question. How do you get an excuse to get out of this committee?
See his paper.
I see.
There is no excuse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I will be happy to give you that answer probably before the conclusion of your taking testimony on this bill. I don't have that in my notes.
Okay. And then follow up if I can.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to... You obviously indicated your willingness to talk about exclusions with stakeholders and so forth. Is it your intention, or can you answer this question, to at least talk about what happens if somebody from out of state but does some business here, takes a loan, would they be, in your view, subject to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, absolutely. They currently are, and they would be continue to be subject to that if they take a loan. And we're pretty clear in our definition, if the individual consumer's here or if the property and subject in question is here.
And one more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And what about if they're servicing a loan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, I believe they'd be subject to it again if you met those original criteria. If the borrower's here in Oregon or if the property that's the subject of the loan is here in Oregon. I think the same criteria would still apply.
Okay. But you,
follow up.
Would you be willing to talk about that with the stakeholders if there's some arguments about servicers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, I'm willing to talk about that, and frankly, and I'm sure I'll get some looks when I get back to the office, I'm willing to discuss this in broad terms around the concept of servicers. I think this issue of servicers is a critical issue, both in terms of the federal government and state government. This is something that this time and in this economy, we need to make sure we don't impede. And so I want to work with that. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I know some of our stakeholders are concerned that this cracks the door open for people who have been drummed out of the loan originator business and use this as a shelter to continue to do business. I'd want to be very careful about crafting carve-outs and exclusions, but I'm certainly open to further discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman. And just real briefly, this bill, as well as licensing, does have some ethics and practices in the bill as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. There are strict prohibitions that all loan originators would be subject to. Talks about there are anti-fraud provisions. There's provisions about how they have to disclose information, and if they don't disclose information, what the requirements are. There's a laundry list of those disclosures in Section 12, and I can walk you through that, but I suspect that each of you would probably find it more informative.
Yeah, it's not necessary.
I did neglect to mention one thing. We also have adopted, and it's right in the front of my testimony, so I apologize. What we have done is we have tried to state in no uncertain terms what we currently is our practice for most of our licensees, and that's all financial services. That is the enforcement of the Real Estate Settlement Provision Act, RESPA, and the Truth in Lending Act. We already examined for that. We already expect compliance with that, but those two laws were part of the changes that came forth out of Washington, D.C. in last summer, and you've heard a great deal about that in one of the other bills, and so I don't want to just go on about that, but we think it's important that we clearly have the authority to enforce that, and we're seeking to have that included in this bill. And you'll see a myriad of provisions after about Section 20 that really addresses that very issue for banks, credit unions, consumer finance lenders, manufactured structured dealers, and I think that's it.
And I guess it would be fair to say then that this bill helps Oregon become consistent with and also not just in compliance with the SAFE Act, but consistent with the all the federal new rules on mortgage lending and the requirements thereof.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. It brings us in compliance. Passage of the bill would bring us in compliance with the SAFE Act, the use of the national database, but also continue to ensure that Oregon's had high standards of consumer protection around the mortgage lending area and fairly aggressive approach to ensuring that consumers are properly dealt with, treated fairly, and protected. And we continue to do that by this bill. So I think it allows us to come into compliance with the federal requirements, but also maintain what I think has been a hallmark of Oregon regulation of mortgage brokers.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tatman. Also, I'd love to thank you, particularly the delegation clauses in here are very narrow. I appreciate that. I just wanted to highlight, I suppose, I've just seen the amendment today.
Right.
I skimmed it. There were two potential issues that jumped out at me, and I just wanted to highlight as you work perhaps over the weekend to perfect it. The first one, do you have it in front of you?
I do.
On page 6, section 4, subsection 1D, it's referring to essentially the requirements for the director of DCBS to issue a license.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty vague. It talked about it's the character and general fitness relative to the confidence of the community. And, of course, this has been used as sort of a prerequisite for other professions. It's in other professions, it's frequently been a basis for racial discrimination and it's political discrimination, religious discrimination, etc. I just want to highlight it. It makes me very nervous. It's also not in the original Model Act. That was issue one. Issue number two, which is on page 13, particularly, so I guess that would be section 8, subsection 3B. And as I read it, and I can't imagine this is intentional, but as I read it, if literally read, it would make any violation of sections 1 through 13, let's pretend an applicant took the test 5 times in a row instead of 4 times, for example, any violation, a Class C felony, regardless of mens rea or anything else. I can't imagine that's what you intended. I think that would be unconstitutional. Perhaps I'm misreading it, but that's what it looks like, literally, it means to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, let me flip these over in order. First, the second one first.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. First of all, our ability to make a referral is just that, a referral. The discretion still lies with the district attorney's office. We work closely with DAs in any number of cases. This is similar language, although not identical, but similar language to what you'll see in the securities law. Absolutely, there is case law that says there is a mens rea of knowingly or intentional. So first of all, you've got to get over that hurdle, and that will always be there regardless of whether it's in the act or not.
Right.
And the fact is that that's in the generic statutes for the criminal code itself. So I don't think it's that omission is fatal by any means. Secondly, we do have discretion to refer somebody or not refer somebody, but again, it is just limited to that, the referral itself. And if frankly, I take a lot of pride in my relationship with all the prosecutors in the state, having been a former prosecutor and having done prosecutorial work in a special capacity while working for the department. And we do not make referrals that are not based on well-intended and clear-cut violations of egregious natures, if you will, major thefts over $100,000 and above. So I can assure you, now I realize tomorrow I'm gone and the next guy comes in here and he decides that anybody that looks at him the wrong way should be prosecuted. But I think that between the integrity of our office and the integrity of any elected district attorney and his or her office, that's just not going to happen. So I think I don't think this creates a loophole. I just think the language is such that it could cause for pause, but in execution it won't be the case. Referring back to your other issue, I will take a second look at that. I will tell you that this is standard language. It is broad as can be. It has never been applied in the 20 years I've been with the department in any way that was untoward or inappropriate. It essentially usually comes down to
either educational or financial responsibility. And the focus of this provision in working with the Model Act itself has been to address the financial responsibility. And we've been talking with Mr. Cosgrove with that very issue, and
I expect
you'll hear more about that.
Can you remind us of where we are on that first question?
I just asked the committee administrator the same thing. Representative Barton.
Sorry.
Representative Barton, what page is that?
There were two. One was on page six, at the bottom.
26.
Line 25.
Line 25 to 29.
My apologies.
Specifically, and then the other one was on page 13. If, I'd love to ask a follow-up when we're up to speed, whenever you...
Well, I think Mr. Tapman just answered the question.
I'd be happy to repeat if people didn't... But the gist of my answer was that we're focusing at this point on the financial responsibility, and we haven't misused that, but I understand the representative's concern. We'll take a second look at that.
Thank you. Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back now to the criminal component, of course, Mr. Tapman, I have the utter trust in your discretion and the director's discretion, and, of course, in the discretion of our excellent prosecutors in this state. Nonetheless, for amongst other things, I think it will significantly improve our fiscal. Second of all, although I do trust you, we have an obligation as a legislature to narrowly tailor. If we're going to create a Class C felony, which is, punishable by a year in prison, I think it is incumbent upon us to make it as narrow and precise as possible. We have to do so knowingly and precisely, as opposed to just make everything a blanket felony and then trust the discretion of agencies and prosecutors. So I really think we're going to have to specify that and narrow that. I suspect, certainly for me to be able to support this, and I suspect perhaps some of my colleagues as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I understand your point, and it may be as simple as putting in the mens rea.
Or alternatively specifying, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Thank you. We're dealing with Acts 1 through 13. That's many pages. Some of this, if violated, is potentially felonious and perhaps should be, and it's clearly egregious. Some of it is far more technical. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's appropriate for us to make everything in here felonious conduct if we violate it. So I think we might have to specify what is a Class C felony, what is a misdemeanor, what is not a violation, not necessarily criminal. I think specificity is critical when creating essentially new crimes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, I agree with you, and I think that's
wonderful.
Something we can move forward on.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman.
That's something we'd probably do internally and just come back and report on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman. I want to keep moving on. I appreciate your introducing this bill. I know it's still got a little more work left to do on it. So obviously we won't be moving it today or probably Monday. With that, I'd like to call up next Paul Cosgrove. Would you like to bring anybody with you, or you want to come solo?
Solo. Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And Tom Hendrickson, since you said that.
That's fine. Mr. Chair, whatever your pleasure is. Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Service Association. In Oregon, we have had mortgage loan originator licensing for some time. Those would be the originators who work for mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, and they're licensed under Chapter 59. Lots of other people do mortgage lending. My clients, the Oregon Financial Service Association, includes people who write mortgage loans. We're licensed under Chapter 725. And for a variety of good policy and practical reasons, throughout the years until Congress acted last year, we have not required mortgage loan originator licensing for anybody other than the employees or contractors for mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. So we are the new ones that are now affected by this process. My members' employees are the ones that are affected by this process that Congress has mandated on the states. Because almost all of my members work in multiple states, including the local homegrown Oregon companies who work across the border in Washington and a couple cases into Nevada and Idaho as well, our major concern, our most major concern, is consistency. If we're going to have a system where where 50 states are now required to license mortgage loan originators. We would like that system to be as consistent as possible in each state for obvious efficiency reasons. But what's being passed out to you is a document that was prepared by our sister organization, the American Financial Services Association. And last fall, shortly after this bill passed, or a couple of months after this bill passed, members of our companies that are members of the Oregon Financial Services Association and the AFSA came to Oregon, met with Corey Streisinger, Mr. Tatman, Lou Savage, and Sarah Hackett about our concerns. And in fact, the concerns listed in this document were discussed in that meeting last fall. So we're not bringing things late or new to the table. They've been things that ever since the process started we had as concerns. And those are, and Mr. Tatman mentioned a couple of them, those start on the third page of this handout, actually the third piece of paper, which talks about model legislation. And I'd like to just briefly highlight where there are still differences between us and our association and our members and the department that we may be able to resolve, but that have been on the table for some time and has not yet been resolved. If you look down on model legislation, the second or third paragraph starts to talk about servicers. This is the concern Mr. Tatman mentioned. It was the subject of some of your questions. Servicers service loans for lots of lenders. They are often located out of state. As part of their job, especially in this day and age, they are being encouraged and in some cases required by the federal government under various federal programs to deal with loan modifications and loan rewrites for borrowers in distress. We want them to do that. But then technically they are often originating a new loan, and we do not want to have them licensed by 50 different states. Having a state license a servicer from out of state to do the loan modification and loan rewrite process will make it less likely that we'll get that process done. Of the states, my understanding is of the states who've passed this model legislation this year, six of them have exempted servicers. We would like Oregon to be in that category. There may have been some that passed it last year when this issue, late in the year of 2008, who did not exempt them. I think they're all taking a look at that for the obvious reason that it makes sense for them when they're rewriting a loan, not necessarily the same process as a loan originator, although they are originating a new loan, to be exempted from this 50-state licensing process. The second issue of concern, and it's at the bottom of this page, is what we have called provisional licensing. Recall that we have employees who have been our employees in originating loans for years in some cases, and this whole system is going to come into place, and they're all going to have to go through education, which may be somewhat duplicate of what they've already done in their careers, and licensing and background checks and criminal checks and all of these things. We want to make sure there's a process so that if the system bogs down, either at the state level or at the national level with this registry, when this flood of new people come in, effective next year, that we can, if they've been, they've made the application and gone through most of the process but still don't have the license, that they can get a provision, the director has the authority to give a provisional license so we don't have to furlough our current employees. We don't think that makes sense for our employees or for the consumers of the state. The third thing is on the next page. There is no known precedent for this, but for whatever reason, Congress suggested that the states could look at both credit reports and credit scores of loan originators when it's looking at licensing them. Credit reports are appropriate because that shows things like bankruptcies, tax liens, or other kinds of things that would be appropriate. It's in fact what we look at when we're hiring someone to see about how they've handled their own finances, if they're going to be handling consumers' finances. But credit scores are a totally different matter. A credit score can be affected by all sorts of things that have nothing to do with whether you're an honest employee. We don't look at it when we hire people, and we think that the department should not be looking at credit scores when it's determining whether that person is licensed and able to work. So that's the third issue. The fourth issue has to do with budget. Mr. Tatman correctly pointed out that the state of Oregon is a member of a trade association, CSBS. It's a member of a second trade association, the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. Congress, in its wisdom, suggested that these two regulators' trade associations form effectively a joint venture, a new entity, which will be the person that is assessing fees on the state and all of us for all of these employees who are going to be registered. It is not only for the ones that the state's licensing, but it's also for the ones that are employees of state banks and credit unions who are going to be registered through the federal agencies. There's not much budgetary control for you or anyone else, and we have asked for a provision that orders the department to request information from this entity and to provide it to you so that if there is, you know, open sunshine on their books, if there is a problem where we all think together that they aren't spending the money appropriately or spending it frivolously, that we can make those wishes known. The state of Oregon doesn't control this entity. The department doesn't control this entity. None of us do, but at least having the books and records open and with a little sunshine on, we think is important and appropriate, given its fee revenue from us. The last thing I want to point out is the way the bill is drafted at the moment is it puts our employees who work for people licensed under Chapter 725 and who are employees of consumer finance companies under part of Chapter 59, which is the mortgage broker banker statute. That's where Class C felonies come in and some of these other provisions. It also causes a number of other kind of strange relationships that really aren't appropriate. We are perfectly happy to stand ready, and if our employees make a mistake, we can be fined. We can have enforcement action against us. We can, all those things that are appropriate in our statute are fine with us. We think in many cases it's not appropriate for the department to have that same authority over our employees. If our employee, let me give you an example, because our software might be malfunctioning one day, issues loan documents that are not in compliance with the Truth in Lending Act. Well, we're supposed to comply with the Truth in Lending Act. And if that's a problem, that's a problem for the company that employed that person. We don't think there should be enforcement authority against that person. And there would be literally hundreds of other examples where we don't think the employee should be standing as the person who is subject to fines, penalties, and potentially criminal enforcement. It is the company who employs the person. If, in fact, we have somebody who's working for us repeatedly does that kind of activity, they're not likely to be working for us for long. But if it's an honest mistake, maybe we get a fine, but we don't think the authority to fine the individual employee is appropriate. So we would suggest, as the HUD administrator who is responsible for implementation of this program has suggested in meetings of regulators in the industry, some of which were attended by both us and by our Oregon regulator, that it's appropriate not to put this into an existing statute that was put together for other purposes, but to have it as a standalone thing. All of the loan originators, whether they work for mortgage brokers, bankers, or consumer finance companies, are regulated the same, but we don't try to put people who are in one kind of workforce into another statute. That's the general review of our concerns. I apologize that I couldn't give you these in writing. We just got these 58 pages, and we haven't yet found where within the 58 pages all of these issues yet are, because it was substantially different format than what the department submitted. We've known what the department has submitted to Legislative Council for some time, but it came back in a completely different rewritten way. I will, over the weekend, be studying the 58 pages and come back to you with, this is the section on this page at this line that has the concern that I've just expressed here, those five concerns. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Thomas R. Hendrickson of Portland, Oregon. I'm Executive Vice President and one of three stockholders of Associated Mortgage Group. We're a residential mortgage brokerage. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. I'm a past president of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, now known as the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association as well. And perhaps notably, for the last 2 years, I've been one of 12 mortgage people nationwide who served on the Mortgage Advisory Council to the SRR, which is the group that Mr. Cosgrove referred to when he talked about the joint venture between the Conference of State Banking Supervisors and Armor to operate the NMLSR. That's the State Regulatory Registry, or SRR. So it's the mega board for all state mortgage regulation in the country, basically, and there are six mortgage brokers and six mortgage bankers in the country that serve on the advisory council to that group, and I'm one of those people. So I've attended meetings over the last 2 years repeatedly in Washington and at Armor conferences across the country and CSBS meetings. So a lot of my life the last couple of years as a volunteer has been spent on this issue. In general, Certainly, Mr. Tapman was correct in saying that, in general, we certainly support the implementation of the SAFE Act. Matter of fact, when the SAFE Act was first passed, within 24 hours, I got a call from a state regulator, mortgage regulator from another state, saying, we thought of you guys immediately in Oregon because we know almost everything's in the SAFE Act is the very stuff you've been lobbying for, trying to get through, and we're unsuccessful in getting through the legislature of your state for the last several years. And we did. A couple years ago, we had a bill before the committee that would have called for licensing of all loan originators in the state, that would have called for strengthened educational and testing requirements and increased criminal background requirements. And unfortunately, we never made it out, but this bill did it, and we're strongly in favor of it. I can't say, I'll talk a little more, I'd be happy to, about the concept in general and about the SAFE Act in general. I can't say with specifics that we're in support of the bill the way it came out this afternoon, because as Mr. Cosgrove said, it was afternoon today was the first time we saw this new 58-page bill. So I've not even had a chance to read every page of it yet. I was actually helping a couple of young consumers buying their first home at the time at 11:46, I think, when Mr. Tapman's office emailed me a copy of it, and I wasn't free until, you know, an hour or two later. And then when I finally got it, it was about time for me to get in my car and drive to Salem. So we would certainly hope to come back, hope to have a chance to testify further on the bill as it's here. And like each of the parties who've spoken before, there are certainly some areas where probably it could be improved through amendments. We don't even know what those are yet until we have a chance to read it, which we haven't done. But the SAFE Act is an important thing. It was, you know, it was H.R. 3221, Title V, passed by Congress. It does, the level playing field is a terribly overused cliche, but it comes closer to that than most any federal legislation. It's without question, in my opinion, the most important piece that this committee will have had to consider in the last two decades of any legislation relating to regulation of the mortgage industry. So it's really an important and a very good bill. I mean, it basically says we're going to have some standards, and they're going to be national standards. It didn't go quite as far as we did in that it lets some of the people off, but there's a lot of talk that the Federal Reserve may step in and increase the standards for the people who are least regulated, which would be the major national banks and their people, to bring them up to the same level. There's a unique identifier, is the quote word that's used in the SAFE Act, that's assigned to every loan originator. And that means everybody, not just the mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, people that are in our groups, but also those who are with not only state and federal chartered credit unions and banks, but also national ones. Everybody in the country who originates a mortgage loan, this is a really wonderful step forward to protect the consumer, is going to have their unique identifier number that's going to go on everything that they do. It's going to go on every loan they originate. It can be used to track the delinquency rate of their loans. It could be if there's fraud involving their loans, if there's things that come up. Right now, you can be, some places like Oregon, have among the strongest regulations in the country in terms of what we have in terms of requirements for education and testing and background checks, but still not as much as we want and not as much as we'll have here. But it's possible for someone to not be able to qualify to work for one of our firms as a loan originator and then go and get a job somewhere else with another financial institution, and that'll be much more difficult for them, because then anybody, whether it's you're crossing over from a bank to a mortgage company to a mortgage broker, vice versa, and wherever you go, it's going to follow you now. So if you're really a crook, if you're really somebody who's been involved, who's been caught, who's been prosecuted in any state in the country. I mean, it used to be pretty easy, I think, for somebody from Florida or Iowa or Nevada to move across to Michigan or California or maybe even Oregon and start originating mortgage loans and have nobody ever figure out what happened. Well, with the national criminal background check through the FBI and the things we're doing in this registry, anytime there's complaints filed against you, not a complaint, I shouldn't say, because a complaint would be hearsay, but anytime there's been an actual prosecution or a consent decree, an action taken that would be a legally binding action in any state, it's going to be in that record nationally, and it will follow people. So that's very, very good. Otherwise, in terms of the financial impact, I think Mr. Tapman mentioned that there is going to be a financial impact on the division. We've already testified in support of the increases in the budget and the funding of the division in order to accommodate the extra people to put this. And even though it does mean that our people are going to have to pay higher fees, we recognize that those higher fees are justified when it comes to having stronger protection for consumers. And, you know, nobody wants our business to be clean more than we want it to be clean. So we're aware of the fiscal impact. fact, we're supporting the steps that are going to have to be taken to pay for that. I don't know that there's much more else. If you have questions, I'd be happy to relate to it, but I would like the opportunity, after we've had a chance to study it, to read it, and to come back, literally even before it went to, this is the draft that the state had before it went into the Legislative Council's office, and this is the one that's quite dissimilar that came out. I've gone through 8 or 9 of these previous versions in working with this task force with CSPS and Armor for, I mean, it's been meetings at least once a month, way 2 hours a week, once a month for the last 2 years, and draft after draft after draft, so it really gets tedious. But we want to read this one, see what's there, and come back to you, and hopefully sometime whenever Chair Holby, you and the committee find it appropriate, whether it's mid or late next week or whenever we have a chance to organize our thoughts, we'd be delighted to come back and speak to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I'll wait for you.
No, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hendrickson is my constituent, and I've known him several years. And I've got to tell you, this is the most excited I've ever seen Mr. Hendrickson.
I try to be equally as excited, Chairman Hobie, when I attend the town hall meeting. Representative Tomei, the next of which is at the Smile office,
that's
coming
right,
up soon.
That's right. That's right. Even close, Tom. Not even close.
Thank you. I'm sure this committee is going to give you a few more hours to look at this. So we don't have this scheduled to move really quick. I know where it's going to go back for some redrafting. It was just very important for our scheduling to get this hearing done today, and get the committee looking at this. Quite frankly, I haven't read any of this amendment yet. Yeah. So I was so impressed that Representative Barton has read any of it prior to this meeting. So I do recognize, some of the issues that Mr. Cosgrove has brought up, and, maybe there is a need for, a much larger rewrite of our statutes and chapters when it comes to loan originating, but I'm not sure that the legislature is in a position to do that this session, but it's certainly something that we should entertain perhaps over the interim and taking a closer look at, how we deal with this perhaps. I'm not perhaps the expert on this, but just in conversations I've had. So I appreciate your testimony and your continued advocacy for loan originators and trying to get these statutes right. I know the department's working very hard, as well as Legislative Council, to make sure we're compliant, and it's very important for us to get this bill through at this session, so I appreciate your help.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chairman, just one comment. The issue about whether these provisions should be in Chapter 59 or another chapter is actually addressed in another bill that's before this committee, 3284, although it was also substantially rewritten from the model that we submitted. So I'm not sure that it exactly does it, but it is actually only a couple of changes that allows that problem to be addressed. Mm. In fact, I think once we read this, none of the problems that I've mentioned or Mr. Tatman's mentioned or Mr. McKinney mentioned is a complicated one from a drafting perspective to address. So we will do our best to do it quickly.
Thank you with that. And
okay, thanks.
Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I move that we hold over 2189.
thank you. I did want to give Gentry Johnson a chance to testify. I don't know if he's going to be able to come back, and we're supposed to be done by 5 o'clock. So I am going to carry this bill over for public hearing on Monday just to finish up any testimony that might be needed to finish this up. Mr. Miner. Okay, great. And Sybil. Thank you with that. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2189. We are going to carry over House Bill 2189. And we already carried over 2815. And also on Monday, we have a work session on House Bill 2470 and 2804, public hearing on 3004, and public hearing on 2199. So with that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.